Hey, get your fresh bizcast here. I'm DC Dennison. This week, a special edition with Boston Capital columnist Stephen Sire. When Steve and I sat down recently, we discussed a whole bunch of topics, from auction IPOs to what Steve calls the single most successful company, pound for pound, in the homeland security sector. What company is that? You'll find out in the following conversation, which began when I asked Steve about the subject of one of his recent columns, Tweeter Home Entertainment Group.
Tweeter, the news is generally not that good when it comes down to making and losing money. They've been losing money for a while now, and they're affected by a lot of different issues that are going into the home entertainment retailing environment right now. But they're under a lot of stress right now, and one particular investor is really putting the hammer to them.
Yeah, he seems to be sort of taking a stake and sort of putting their feet to the fire.
This is a guy named Mark Wattles, and he got in business years ago by starting a company called Hollywood Entertainment. This is sort of the Blockbuster competitor. They're bigger in other parts of the country, but you see them around here sometimes. And he started that business with his wife, built it up into something big, and then eventually it got caught up in kind of a takeover environment where he tried to take the company private with some investors. Blockbuster stepped in and tried to take it over, and eventually he ended up leaving the company. But along the way, he got into the electronics retailing business. He found a company called Ultimate Electronics, which was just dying at the time he found it. It was going into bankruptcy. He acquired a controlling interest in bankruptcy. It had, I believe, something like 64 stores spread around the country, shut half of them, and operates the other half today. And then much more recently, very recently, he popped up for the first time as a big shareholder of Tweeter, filed and said, I own about 10% of the company, and I'm looking at you, and I haven't decided what I think about you yet. And then very soon thereafter, he said, I've looked closely, and you don't have that much money. And you could, if you don't do well at Christmas time, you could be in trouble. And under the right terms, I might write you a check, but maybe not. And the Tweeter management responded, as you can imagine, not very kindly to that. And then he came back and said, "Oh, by the way, now I own 12% of you. I've been buying more stock, and I think you should get rid of the poison pill defense you have and de-stagger your board, which makes it possible for in one election for the entire board to be voted out. Makes it much more easy for an outside raider like potentially Mark Wattles to take over the company." And again, getting a bristling response.
Do you think a year from now he could be totally in the driver's seat?
It's possible, but I think an awful lot of things can happen. Mark Wattles has a point when he says things aren't going well. Tweeter is a company that went public in the late 90s with a big expansion plan. They took their IPO money and subsequently raised a lot more money in secondary offerings, about $200 million altogether, and started going around the country buying up other companies that looked like them, kind of a roll-up strategy. Got much bigger, and retail companies that expand by buying other companies typically screw it up somewhere along the line. And if you look back at all the money Tweeter has raised selling stock, the $200 million, and then look at what's happened to it, in the meantime, they've lost about $200 million. So you could pretty much make a corollary and say they blew that money.
Yeah.
And now, Mark Wattles has a point that if they don't have a good Christmas, and in the case of high-end electronics, particularly TVs, Super Bowl becomes its own special season if they don't do well there. Tweeter will, in fact, probably need some money, and it'll put them in a vulnerable position. Mm-hmm. Now, they have other alternatives. Tweeter owns its headquarters building. It could sell it and lease it back. Mm-hmm. They have other interests that they could sell and raise money. But basically, this is a company that went out there, raised a lot of money, and kind of screwed it up. The CEO left earlier this summer, and a new guy is in there, and they are, in fact, under the gun. Whether this guy, Mark Wattles, is in a position to do something, it's hard to tell. A lot of people think he's a big faker and he doesn't really have any credentials. Mm-hmm. This other company that he has acquired in the field, Ultimate Electronics, although technically in the same business, their stores don't look anything the same. Ultimate Electronics is kind of a big box retailer acres of floor space, where Tweeter, we all know, is a very cozy, intimate place.
Right.
And we'll see what happens. Tweeter was hurt like a lot of retailers more recently when prices of big TVs went way down and all of a sudden they lost an advantage. But then pretty quickly people realized that I need help putting all this stuff together. It's really complicated. I can't do it. And that a tweeter kind of repositioned itself as come here and we're the people who can best help you figure out how to take this thing from the showroom into your living room and make it all work. Whether that strategy can, you know, be executed successfully remains to be seen, but there is a viable option there.
Yeah, it seems like one question I had was, you know, why would anyone want to get into this business? It seems so cutthroat and the margin seems so thin. But the service idea that they're rolling out now actually kind of, you know, that will be fun to watch to see if that works.
Well, everybody realizes that the service element is a big deal. Remember, not so long ago, Best Buy got into a big legal fight over the geek squads and things like that because they realized that component is really critical to the average buyer.
Yeah. So that will be fun to watch. You know, another stock and sector that you've been watching is the kind of homeland security sector. That's one that I remember, you know, the day after 9/11, you know, 9/12, people started talking about homeland security. And you've written about one of our local players. And has that worked out for them?
This is a company called American Science and Engineering, and they're in Billerica. And for my money, I think they're the single most successful stock, pound for pound anyway, that you can point to in the sort of post 9/11 homeland security environment. I think they've been hugely successful. And as a matter of fact, right now in the last month or so, as you measure by stock price anyway, the thing has been booming.
So what do you see in the future? Do you think they're going to keep on that trajectory, or is that kind of a risky play for them?
I think right now they're quite successful. To take a step back and say exactly what they do, this is a company that is in the business of scanning for explosives, particularly plastic explosives and things like that. And one of their most popular products is a scanner that they can put in a van. They can put in a commercial van like buy on the street, and they can drive around without any big booms or anything sticking out of it and drive by a car and look at it and say, does this car have, is the trunk loaded with plastic explosives? Is it dangerous to us? The military is a big buyer. Lots of government agencies are big buyers. Foreign governments are big buyers. This has been a hugely successful product and really the driver right now. They also have other products that I think over a period of a couple of years are going to be very successful. They're very big. The FAA and airport security people are very interested in this idea of scanning people better as they go through. And the good news is that American Science and a couple of other companies have come up with technology that's very good. The problem is, in some ways, it's too good that there are privacy concerns. And if DC, if you walk through one of these scanners, someone would get an extremely intimate profile of you. And one of the big commercial issues in terms of selling these things is creating a mathematic algorithm in which they can create an image that is good enough to tell you what you need to know for safety reasons, but not good enough so that there's some proprietary, and I don't mean business proprietary, I mean personal proprietary issues.
Wow. Could be a whole new market for them down the road sometime.
It is. They also are involved in other products that hopefully will be big in the future, which have to do with scanning container trucks and containers and things like that coming off ships coming into American ports. Clearly, ports are a big point of entry security issue right now that has to be addressed. Hopefully that'll happen right now. The stock in this company has been booming in August. It gained about $24 to about 63, something like that. So that's a big move. That's about 50% in this past month. The big issue there is that government agencies are by far their biggest customers, and a lot of the financial planning for what's going to be spent next year has been happening in the last couple of months. And so this is the time of year when orders are announced. So, boom, a big order. The Marines just came out with a very big order for one of these things that you stick in vans. So investors are very upbeat in what they're seeing in the new orders happening right now.
I see. Auction IPOs. Google is the most famous, but you've recently...
We're switching subjects, Blake.
Hey, this is the best of. You know, it's like a medley. So Google, of course, put it on the map for many people, but You've recently written about a saddle company that's taken this approach. What are the pros and cons for some of these companies?
We're talking about Dover Saddlery, a company I'd never heard of until a couple of weeks ago in Middleton, I believe. Well, the auction IPO market is interesting in that this is a function that's only existed for about, I believe, 6 years now. 1999, I believe a company called W.R. Hambrick on the West Coast rolled these things out. And as you point out correctly, Google put it on the map when they had an auction IPO. Obviously, a big boom. But this year, this summer, something as important to the product was that Morningstar, the mutual fund advice company, went public using the same type of mechanism quite successfully. And although Morningstar is quite well known, it's much smaller than Google and doesn't have kind of the rock star status. So how that did was a big deal. So maybe it's helpful to take a moment to describe sort of how the typical company goes public and how an auction IPO is different. If the DC Denison company was going public in a conventional way, you as the CEO would contact Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or some investment banking company like that and say, I want to go public. And what they would do is they would do something called a book building process. And what they would do is they would go to all their big institutional customers like Vanguard and Fidelity and things like places like that and say, you know, we have a great opportunity. The DC Denison company is going public and here's some information about them. Are you interested and how much would you be interested in buying in them? And along the way, a big part of the process would be something that the bankers call price discovery. And by this process of going around to investors and gauging their interest, they would come back to you as the CEO and say, here's how much stock we think the market will absorb and roughly what they would be willing to pay for it. They would discover a price for your stock.
Yeah.
And then that you'd go along that path and then they would, in fact, roll you out and sell your shares to these institutional investors. You'd hit the market and start trading, and there you go. That would be the normal process. The auction IPO is much different. A company like W.R. Hambrick opens the process up not to just Morgan Stanley's favorite institutional clients, but literally to anybody, just as Google did.
Yes.
And when Google went public, I, for the purposes of writing columns, did exactly this, and I put in a bid for the minimum number of shares, which in Google's case was 5 shares. And the company can suggest a price range, but it's only a suggestion. And then I submitted a bid. And I believe I put in a bid for $110 a share, if I can recall correctly. And what happens is that the company collects all the bids, and it decides what it can sell. And it starts going from the people who offered the most amount of money going down. And then eventually they gauge the interest and they cut it off. And you can lowball a bid, but the risk is that they won't accept you because they cut the line off. And everybody who is accepted pays the same price just because somebody offered 25 a share and somebody else offered 23 per share. If they decide the price is 24, everybody pays that 24. It's the cut off where the bidding price matters, and then they launch it, and this has happened very well as for Google and now Morningstar, and a new crop of companies has come out, and they've been a complete different range of companies. Dover Saddlery, which makes riding saddles and other equestrian equipment, has used it. There's a company called Traffic.com that supplies traffic reports for radio and TV stations. And then there's another company that owns radio spectrum for
licenses
cellular TV, telephones, things like that. So companies in radically different businesses have all come out in the last week and said, we're going to do auction IPOs. And I think mostly they all looked at the success of Morningstar. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's pros and cons to this. And the cons are that what if we don't get enough interest? And it's easy for Google to say we can go out and do an auction because literally millions of people are interested in, you know, owning Google shares.
Right.
But what if you're Dover Saddlery? How many people really are going to be interested enough to create this critical mass of demand to make it successful? So I think the Morningstar example was a big deal for these companies, seeing how a company who's big but not quite like Google was able to pull it off. You know, the people who support auction IPOs say, look, the conventional process is completely corrupt. You know, what happens is a company pays a lot of money to an underwriter, about 7% typically of the amount being raised. And they go out and they go to their best customers.
Yeah.
And they say, here you go, Fidelity, you've bought 20 of our last IPOs. We'll make this a kind of cheap price and we'll give it to you. And what do you know? As a result of being in on the ground floor when the public can't get in and they're clamoring to get into a popular IPO, the price is going to go up by 50% the next day and you're going to have made a lot of money. And this is a way for your mutual funds to do quite well in the aggregate. So you keep coming back to us each time and we'll take care of you.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, back at the D.C. Denison Corporation, you know, you've raised $50 million by selling stock at $10 per share, but the stock has popped and the next day it's worth $20 a share.
You see none of that.
Well,
and,
you know, you left half your money on the table. What's up with that?
Right.
So, you know, people were in favor of saying it's much more transparent. We have the Fidelity is still invited to bid. It can do whatever it wants.
Good point.
But so is everybody else. And we get a much more transparent look at what the market really believes this company is worth, what the real demand is, and it's more democratic, it's more transparent, and everybody makes out better. And, you know, who loses out? Well, the investment banks lose out. Who's creating all the stink? The investment bankers are whining. So, you know, I would say there's some give and take there. It's not a vehicle for everybody, but it's a very good option, I think, for everybody to consider. And I'm glad that it appears to be gaining momentum as a viable alternative.
Yeah, it seems to have. I remember when Google...
You know, those types of funds have done better and have done worse in different types of investing environments.
Right.
Right now, I would say, overall, they're doing worse than the market. During the 90s, they outperformed the market. If you put Amy's index next to the S&P 500, she was really kicking it for you know, during the late 90s. Right now, not as much. And that doesn't have to do really with anything about social issues per se. It has to do with what types of companies social screens point you toward. For example, for example, right now, oil companies, heavy manufacturing companies, you know, oil and oil services is a big driver in the stock market right now. You know, but typically they don't have very good environmental records.
Right.
And so those are the types of companies that get screened out.
Yeah.
So you're basically losing some of the market's big winners right now as a result of that. Well, if you go back to the 90s, those types of companies were nowhere, the oil service companies, so it didn't matter that they were screened out. But what typically gets screened in is high tech companies.
Yeah, right.
You know, they're pretty good about how they treat a lot of their employees. Although they have environmental issues, they're not big polluters.
Yeah,
like
they don't have
oil
brown
services.
Fields anywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously those stocks were going gangbusters in the 90s, so the socially responsible funds were doing really well. And so it comes and goes, but often it has to do with you know, how the screens distribute your money, not how the world treats socially social issues.
Right. And you know, there could even be sort of socially responsible energy companies, or manufacturing companies, but they're always going to have some things that show up on those on those screens, because they do have such assets, you know, where they have you know, materials and they have to get rid of stuff. So you could see where they would show up if you're doing some sort of socially responsible screen, just in environmental things. Whereas, you know, Google would never show up because they don't have any tankers or factories or anything.
None that we know of, although they're spending money on things like crazy at the moment. We're still not sure what they're buying.
That's true. Man, maybe they'll show up. One thing I wanted to cover just quickly is a company I like to call TKT.
That's because the real name is too hard to say.
Transcoriatic
Therapies.
unbelievably complicated name. Always have
the good news is the company has been sold and it doesn't exist anymore.
Oh,
it was acquired by Shire.
Oh, okay.
Company that's easier
Thank
to say.
Thank God, yes. Now, you've been following them for a while, and recently they came back into the news.
They did, very briefly. The former CEO, a guy named Richard Selden, was charged civilly by the Securities and Exchange Commission very recently in his role as the CEO of TKT. For events going back to the early 2000s, 2001. Mm-hmm. And this was an issue I raised first in 2003, I believe. It's over 2 years ago now. And it's come back finally to haunt him. And what's important to know is TKT, which is in Cambridge, and another Cambridge company, Genzyme, at that point in time, were both in a race to develop a drug, an orphan drug, for a very rare disease called Fabry's disease, which only affects a couple of thousand people in the United States.
And that's their thing, orphan drugs, right?
It's Genzyme's thing, specifically. But the great thing about developing a drug, an orphan drug, is A, you help people who need help, but B, because you're going out and spending a lot of money developing a drug for a narrow niche, the government gives you this sort of unique protection from competition for a period of years. So in a rarity, two companies were pursuing the same orphan drug status for a new drug. So that meant potentially one of them could be left completely out in the cold. And so they were going at it tooth and nail. And finally, in 2003, TKT got their drug before the FDA. And the FDA said, well, you know, this just doesn't work well enough, and you lose pretty much. And this was a big blow. But what was really important at that time was, you know, this isn't a process that happens overnight. The FDA was communicating with the company for years, but that communication is considered private and proprietary information, and certainly the FDA doesn't disclose it. And they, for the first time, they came out and they said, you know, going back to 2001, we told you, you know, the data stunk on this thing. And you go back and you start looking at that, what TKT said about its drug back then. They said a few vague things, like the FDA looked at our application and they've asked us for some more information. And it was really a lot worse than that. And, you know, the company really, by the SEC's allegation now, misled investors for a long period of time. And, you know, the company sold more stock. Analysts were following this company thinking their drug application was going better than it really was. And the whole thing kind of fell in a heap eventually. And so the SEC started investigating right after I wrote about it in 2003, as a matter of fact. And finally, have come out, and the interesting thing is they've absolved the company. The company cooperated from the start. You know, the former CEO Richard Selden became a former CEO quite a while ago, and they pursued him instead. And you know, the company cooperated. The company doesn't have a lot of money, or never did really, to find them, and it doesn't exist anymore as a result of Shire very recently acquiring it. But it said, you know, you, Richard Selden, you screwed up here, and you personally sold stock, by the way, along the way. And it's a very kind of hot-button issue on a lot of fronts. A, you have this issue about, you know, do you pursue companies for wrongdoing, or to pursue the people who were at the levers. And this was a very important issue when Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm, was under the gun. And Arthur Andersen eventually imploded, and thousands of people lost their jobs. You know, obviously thousands of innocent people lost their jobs because arguably, you know, very, very bad and greedy decisions by a relatively few number of people. And I don't want to say what the outcome of the Selden case at TKT is, but they've clearly targeted an individual here. You also have another hot button issue of, you know, this, the correspondence of a drug in development with the FDA. You know, what is fair game for investors to know and not know? You know, that's something that's still being played out. And this is, I would say, a prime example of, you know, a situation where, you know, maybe investors should not have known everything, but clearly they didn't know enough, and arguably they were being misled. You know, the FDA, it isn't like a black and white thing where the FDA says, gives you a green light or red light. You know, it's a much vaguer collaborative process. And to be honest, I think companies have a point where they say, you know, what should we say? say that's clear. You know,
yeah.
it isn't even clear to us sometimes what's being said right away. So,
wow, that's that makes biotech so interesting in terms of, you know, what, how much visibility investors have in,
right.
into that.
That's why I love this TKT case
yeah.
right now, and it's, you know, it's still not quite done being played out.
Yeah.
You know, Selden and his lawyers are fighting this vehemently.
Wow. One company that's had some scandal that you sort of looked right through is Fidelity. When people were talking about the partying and the payoffs, that kind of thing, you started talking about something that's almost a more serious problem for them, their sales.
Absolutely.
I mean, what did you discover in that case?
Well, first of all, I don't want to minimize the effect of the scandals going
yeah.
on at Fidelity. I mean, there are allegations of some, you know, pretty egregious things
mm-hmm.
happening, but in the big picture, in terms of what's really affecting the company and thousands of people who work there, is the fact that, you know, Fidelity was a sales juggernaut in the mutual fund world
mm.
for many, many years, and it is not anymore.
Yeah.
And it's really, in fact, struggling. You know, Fidelity right now, just to give you a little perspective, you know, the American Funds, a company that's on the West Coast, is by far and away the mutual fund sales leader. And, you know, for every dollar of net sales, which is a figure that takes into account how much sales are coming in and how much company investors are asking for their money back to get kind of a net number, it's a 10 to 1 with American funds compared to Fidelity. Vanguard is also, you know, a much more successful company in this point in time. A lot of it has to do with performance, and that's not the only issue, but it's a
mm-hmm.
big issue. And, you know, Fidelity just doesn't have that many really, really strong funds right now. It has a bunch of okay funds.
Mm.
And, you know, their biggest single problem is the fact that, you know, their most famous and still biggest fund, Magellan, Fidelity Magellan, is, you know, has a long, long, mediocre record right now. What was once the flagship, you know,
yeah.
star of that company is a marginal laggard in
mm-hmm.
every conceivable statistical category.
Mm-hmm. And kind of so big and you know, unwieldy that a lot of people stay away from it.
Absolutely. You know, Fidelity Magellan right now accounts for almost all of its new money out of 401k plans. It's been marginally closed for a long time to brand new investors.
Mm-hmm.
And it counts on the 401k crowd for about 80% of its money in
mm.
terms of new flow. But, you know, the companies and that employ people who put money into their 401k and the advisors that they hire for advice on investments have become pretty sophisticated at this stuff over a period of years. And they look at a fund like Magellan. They say, okay, this is our investment option for our employees in the large company stock category.
Yeah.
And I say, all right, in that world, how has it performed? And the way that they dice this up is they look at performance over different time frames, and they
mm-hmm.
say, okay, over the last 3 years, Magellan is underperforming. It's below average. Over 5 years, it's below average.
Oh,
over
wow.
10 years, it's below average.
Oh, wow.
And at some point, you say,
yeah.
exactly why is this fund
yeah.
in our menu of options?
Right.
And eventually, advisors that do their job say, you got to get this thing out of here and put a different fund in here. And that's typically what is happening to Magellan in drips and drabs. It's a death of a thousand cuts
yeah.
all over the country. But if you come back now to Fidelity overall and you say, well, our sales are pretty weak, but why are they pretty weak? Let's put a chart of every fund we have out and what their net flow number is. You'll see that there are a couple of pretty good funds, and then there are this large basket of funds that are kind of not doing anything one way or another. And then there's kind of this black hole that's Magellan, because it's so big that a significant percentage net outflow of money of Magellan is a lot of dollars.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's billions and billions and billions of dollars in the past year that have come out of Magellan that Fidelity has a hard time patching that with the rest of their portfolio
yeah.
because there aren't that many big stars to make up for it.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, that will be fun to watch. Finally, I've noticed you sitting at your terminal scratching your head, working on your upcoming column.
I always scratch my head.
What's this will be out by the time this comes out on Wednesday. Your column will have already been out. But what are you thinking about right now?
I'm going to write about this TKT issue,
Cool.
And sort of the implications for that and this latest turn, which is the SEC lawsuit against the former chairman.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well, I look forward to reading that as always. So, Steve, thanks a lot for all your time.
Thanks, DC.
Thanks for listening, and check in next Wednesday for a brand new BizCast. Or better yet, subscribe and have BizCast automatically delivered to your computer and MP3 player.